Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Daniel Tammet's mind works in brilliant ways. When he closes his eyes, numbers in shapes and colors ripple through his mind. He can make calculations and recall information in a snap. He's an autistic savant diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, a high-functioning form of autism that allows him to live independently and run his own company. Englishman Daniel Tammet in 2004 recited the number pi to the 22,514th digit at Oxford University without making a single mistake. He speaks 10 languages, including Icelandic, which he learned in a week, and he lived in Lithuania where he taught English. He's written a memoir called Born on a Blue Day. There's been a bit of a delay getting Daniel Tammet on the line, some sort of problem with the connection to England. So I'd like to first turn to Geraldine Dawson. She is a professor of psychology at the University of Washington and the director of the university's Autism Center. She's also the author of A Parent's Guide to Asperger's Syndrome and High-Functioning Autism, How to Meet the Challenges and Help Your Child Thrive. Dr. Dawson, it's nice to have you with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Tell us about Daniel Tammet. We've heard, I've just expressed some of his extraordinary talents and abilities. Help us understand how unusual and special he is.
Well, he's certainly a remarkable man. We don't see these kinds of exceptional skills that often, even in the autistic savant. So when we do obviously see amazing memory skills, sometimes mathematics skills, musical skills, but Daniel is exceptional even among the savants.
So there are single skills that are often extraordinary, but he has sort of all of it put together.
Yes, it's remarkable. I mean, it's remarkable that he's excels in his memory skills, in languages, mathematics. He's quite a brilliant young man.
So the epileptic seizures that he suffered when he was just a child, typically, to the extent that those happen with him, they can be very damaging to the brain. But in his case, they changed him in a remarkably good way. Is that right?
Yes. We can speculate that those seizures might have rewired his brain in some way to actually accentuate his abilities in certain areas.
Professor, I'm going to put you on hold because we have finally made our connection to England. I'd like to bring in now Daniel Tammet. He's the author of a new memoir called Born on a Blue Day. Daniel, it's so nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Hello, thank you.
We were just talking about your abilities and how unique you are. You are so because of your relationship with numbers. How would you describe that relationship, Daniel?
I would describe it as very much as a relationship, as numbers being my friends, each one having its own personality, its own color or shape and texture. And for a long time in childhood, the other children, I had no relationship with them. So numbers were the things that I could relate to. They were the things that were most real to me. They were living things to me, and I could relate to them and just be very, very happy with them.
I want to give people an idea of your ability, if that's all right. You calculate numbers instantly. So if I told you my birth date, you could make an immediate calculation about it in many ways. Is that right?
Hopefully, yes.
May I?
Sure.
April 25th, 1967.
You were born on a Tuesday.
And I will turn 60 when?
Well, in 2037.
And on what day?
On a Saturday.
What about multiplication? 92, say, I pick a number out of a hat. 92 times 92 times 92.
Well, if you don't mind, I won't do calculations. I won't do sums. One of the things that I try not to do when I give media interviews is do too much that will feed the stereotype of savants as people who will just do sums, if you understand. The calculation skills that I have been tested at Cambridge University here in the UK and at the Centre of Brain Studies in California. One of the things that my parents made me promise them before I did the documentary film that people know me for in 2004 and then subsequently wrote my memoir was I had to promise them that I wouldn't become what they described as a performing seal. Mm. So,
well, I guess what I was trying to get at is trying to have you articulate or explain how it is that you do what you do, what the process is, if you will.
Sure, I appreciate that very much. I mean, a very simple example would be to multiply a number like 2, which is something I've done since I was a very small child. So I would go, for example, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 1, 2, 8, 2, 5, 6, 5, 12, 1, 0, 2, 4, 2, 0, 4, 8, 4, 0, 9, 6, 8, 1, 9, 2, 1, 6, 3, 6, 1, 6, 3, 8, 4, 3, 2, 7, 6, 8, 6, 5, 5, 3, 6, 1, 3, 1, 0, 7, 2, 2, 6, 2, 1, 4, 4, 5, 2, 4, 2, 8, 8, 1, 0, 4, 8, 5, 7, 6. 2090152 and so on and on. And what I'm doing there is I take the number and I multiply it by itself. And in the case of the number 2, it's obviously the smallest prime number. It's a golden number for me. It's a very shiny floating number. And when I multiply it by itself so many times over, like I just did, it forms sparks in my mind, kind of like fireflies all over my head, a very beautiful sensation. So the further I go in the calculation, the more these sparks, the more these fireflies are all around my head. And it's a very calming sensation as well, because the relationship I have with numbers means that they calm me down. I have this relationship that many people would have with friends, with other people, that you feel comfortable with them, you feel relaxed with them, you can be yourself with them. And that's how I feel with numbers.
So when you say you see the number and the sparks that appear, it almost forms a landscape, if you will?
That's right. For very long numbers, you mentioned the number pi, I think, at the start of the show. And pi is an infinite number. It literally goes on forever. What I did was recite it from memory 3 years ago to 22,514 places. It took over 5 hours to recite from start to finish. And I describe it in the book as like running a marathon in my head. And with that stream of digits, all of the colours and the shapes and the textures that I see for these different numbers, they pull together, knit together into a kind of numerical landscape in my mind. And it's just beautiful for me. And I, as a child especially, would just spend hours in my room in the silence, because silence had a texture for me. Silence was a beautiful thing as well. Mm. And I would sit in that silence and would just surround myself with these numerical landscapes.
So if one number has a shape and a texture and a color, can you possibly describe pi with 22,514 digits? Can you possibly articulate what that looks like for you?
I would say it's just an extremely beautiful number. It's full of colors. It's full of shapes, of course, because it's so long. It's an extremely complex shape for me. But one thing that I did when I got to the end of that recitation, after more than 5 hours, in my mind's eye, I looked back and I could see all of them, all the 22,514 digits, in my mind's eye, in one instant. And I turned to them and I waved them goodbye, because I knew that I wasn't going to see them again. I was never going to do this feat again. It was for a very particular event. I was raising money for an epilepsy charity because I had epileptic seizures as a small child. And so it was a very emotional moment for me to reach that point. I was then 25, and I had come so far already in my life.
I read that it was an important moment for you, and you prepared by, I read in the book, gorging on the numbers, hundreds of them at a time, and to open the floodgates was an important, significant time for you.
Absolutely. I had reached a point where I could belong to numbers, but not be overwhelmed by them. I could belong to both countries of the mind, both the world of people and the world inside my head, the world of numbers and words and language. I could belong to both worlds simultaneously, have dual nationality in both. And so I went as far as I could into this other place in my mind, but not to feel that I had to go there, but to go there and to pay it homage, in a sense, for all that it gave me in childhood, but also to feel that I could move on as well.
So you can remember 22,514 numbers in perfect order. Is there anything, Daniel, that you easily forget?
Yes, I easily forget faces. Faces are very difficult for me to remember. I've since read that it's quite a common part of having autism, even very mild autism, as in my case, that faces are very difficult. Photos aren't so hard, in a sense. I can look at a photograph, and I think with an actual face in person, it's because the face is moving all the time, and there are expressions, and it's very hard to pull all of different details together. One thing that I do, and lots of people on the autistic spectrum do, is we look at the details in any given thing, and it's very hard to pull all those details together and see the bigger picture. And that's something I still find difficult to this day.
Do you have a favorite number?
I have lots of numbers that I love. Every number is special to me. But my absolute favorite, aside from pi, obviously, would be the number 4. Because the number 4 is a very pointy number, so it's very distinct for me. And it's beautiful, but also it's a shy number. And I don't know why it's shy, but I've always thought of it as shy, and it just reminds me of myself.
Hmm. Daniel, as I mentioned, there are only 50 true savants in the world today, but none are quite like you. You are articulate. You are self-sufficient. You have this spectacular capacity of a savant, and yet you have very little disability. I want to sort of delve into why that is. You grew up in a family in East London, one of 9 children. Your mom, as I read in your book, said you were not an easy baby. What were some of the early signs that you were different as a child?
Well, the earliest memories that my mother has of me is just crying constantly, all of the time. From the time that I was born, I just cried solid for the first, I would say, 2 years, I think. And I think the only thing that my parents found that would soothe me was to put me in a blanket, to take one end each and to rock me from side to side, kind of like a hammock. And somehow that repetition soothed me and stopped me crying. They became so worried in the end that I was not responding, crying constantly, that they brought in a health visitor. And the health visitor said that I was either understimulated or overstimulated, and that I needed to be placed at a nursery, at a kindergarten, as soon as possible when I was 2. But when I went there, I didn't really relate to any of the other children. I had no sense of wanting to relate to them. I had no sense of children, people in general, as being like myself, as having feelings, emotions, as I had. And so I would just spend all of my time really in my own world, playing with toys, but in a very idiosyncratic way. I would take sand, for example, hourglasses. I was fascinated by the flow of the sand in them, and I would just repetitively play with sand and watch how the sand would move and flow.
And as you were 4 years old, I believe, the epileptic seizures began, and that changed a lot, right?
Absolutely. Epilepsy, unfortunately, occurs very often for people on the autistic spectrum. 1 in 3 people with autistic spectrum disorders will have at least one seizure, probably more than one seizure, by adolescence. And in my case, I had temporal lobe epilepsy. The temporal lobes are just above the ears, and they affect memory, and are deeply involved in how we perceive ourselves, how we understand ourselves.
And typically seizures of this kind are damaging to the brain, and yet in your case, they open things up in quite an extraordinary way.
Yes, it would seem so. Perhaps because I was so young when I had the seizures, so the brain was still growing, it was still pliable. I don't really know, and scientists who've looked at me don't yet understand why my brain is the way it is. Certainly the wiring would appear to be slightly different, but not so different that I'm incapable of leading, as you mentioned, a relatively normal life.
And yet you say in the book that that often through the years you have willed yourself to interact in the world. Simple things like making eye contact, standing in someone else's space, you write. These were all conscious decisions for you.
Absolutely. Very, very conscious. I don't know where this willpower comes from. I think it comes from my parents, who themselves are very willful people, to bring up 9 children in East London at a time when they had very little money and very little resources. It took a lot of willpower to do that.
And you didn't retreat into the mysterious sort of prison of autism, you write, because you had to do so much for yourself in such a large family.
I think my large family did actually, as you say, contributed a lot to my progress, because I couldn't absorb myself too much in my own world, in the world of numbers or language, because my brothers and sisters were always there for me, and I owe them a huge amount of gratitude for what they have helped me to achieve. Mm.
You live with your partner of 6 years outside London. Can you help us understand your daily routine, Daniel Tammet?
Yes, I lived in London until I was in my early 20s, and then I met someone, fell in love, and that was a wonderful experience, a turning point in my life. I find emotions difficult to understand, and love is such a big emotion to understand for anyone, let alone someone with autism. And what I found helped me to understand it was a story that I read in The Little Prince, where it's explained that if you look into a sea of a million faces and you see only one, your beloved's, then you know that you're in love. And I've had this experience many times where I'm giving talks for schools, for example, with children with special educational needs. And my partner comes with me. My partner drives me everywhere because I can't drive a car. And I look into that sea of faces and I see only my partner's. And it just helps me to stay calm and focused. Mm. Where I live now is in a place called Kent, which is just south of London. It's called the Garden of England. It's quite rural. There's horses and fields and flowers and fruit trees. It's a beautiful, calm, quiet place. And I describe my home as like an oasis outside of all of the noise and the tensions and the stresses of the outside world. My home is quiet and peaceful and calm, and I feel very happy there.
You have a certain routine that you write about in the book. You splash water in your face 5 times every morning. You count the items of clothing that you're wearing. It's a very distinct and regimented a way of living.
Absolutely. But I the way that I look at it is that it's not so much routine as ritual. It's a way of ritualizing my life and of sacramentalizing it, in a sense. I'm a religious person. That's another thing that people find unusual for someone with autism, although in the book I point out there are other autistic writers who are spiritual people as well. I don't think that religion and autism are incompatible. And for me, ritual is very important, both in the religious and non-religious context. As you say, there are all sorts of things that I need to do each day to feel comfortable. That's a part of my condition. But I think it's also a part of making each day special, meaningful, giving it a shape and a substance that I can engage in and feel comfortable with.
You write in the book that you often feel assaulted by stimuli. As you mentioned, you don't drive. You can't go to the grocery store. What is it about these simple things, the ringing of a phone or a friend dropping by unexpectedly, that's difficult for you?
In the case of a friend dropping by, it would be if it's unexpected, and then it would be uncomfortable because I set up a routine, a schedule in my head, and if it then goes out, if it then is broken, that's an uncomfortable thing. It's like dropping something and smashing it. So it's a tangible sense of something being broken. Ideas for myself certainly are tangible things. They're real things, just as I describe numbers as having shapes and words as having their own colors and textures. So ideas too are tangible things, and if a schedule, an idea of how a day is meant to be run, is interfered with and broken down, then that's really uncomfortable for me.
In the case of going to the beach, it's difficult for you to do that, because why?
In the case of a beach, if there's so many things to count, so many pebbles or so many grains of sand, it can make me feel uncomfortable because it's a sense of a sum being undoable. And that's a big thing. It's like love, going back to the idea of love and an emotion being too big for us to contain as human beings. Grief is another emotion that seems too big for us to contain, and yet somehow we have to come through those emotions or become a part, you know, become comfortable within them. And so I think my experiences show, as you mentioned yourself earlier, that maybe there isn't so much difference in the end between us as human beings. We each see the world slightly differently. We each have our own gifts, but in the end, we're all human, and maybe that's what makes us all so special.
Daniel Tammet is an artistic savant with extraordinary abilities to calculate huge sums. You speak 10 languages. You learned Icelandic in a week. There are only 50 people in the world with his abilities. I want to ask you, when you were 9 years old, you saw the movie Rain Man, the story of an autistic savant named Kim Peek. Do you remember your reaction to that movie? Do you remember thinking, that's me?
I do remember watching the film. I watched it with my family. It was a huge film, of course, at the time. And it won an Oscar. And I've since held that Oscar when I met Kim Peek, the real Kim Peek, the real person on whom the Dustin Hoffman character was based, in Utah, in Salt Lake City, 3 years ago. And that was an incredible experience. Going back to the film, I remember watching it and feeling for the first time as if I was beginning to understand what made me different from other people, because at that point I was just beginning that journey of self-discovery. I was just beginning to come outside of myself and to realize that other people were people like I was a person and had feelings and had ideas, and that the way I saw the world, the way that I engaged with the world, was different to how other people did. But I didn't automatically say that's me, because of course the character is very different from me in some important respects.
Well, I was going to mention, I actually once interviewed Kim Peek in Salt Lake City, and I guess the difference that I sense between the two of you is you are so introspective and so articulate, which is so rare among savants. And I guess that leads to the question, what are doctors and scientists learning about your brain and how it works, and how will that help others?
Well, as you say, there are scientists who are studying me both in the United States and in the United Kingdom at Cambridge University. There's an autism research center there. And what they're finding is that it's to do with the way that I perceive things, my ability to see things as shapes, because that's a very tangible way of taking something like numbers, which for most people are intangible. You don't get a sense of what the difference is between a number like 4 and a number like 21 or 37 or 109. But when I see it, those numbers, when I hear them and I see them in particular, they have their own colors, they have their own shapes. So I can use that information, that extra information, which my head just gives me. And why that is, they're still looking at. I don't know if there is any easy answer to that. It's an ongoing process, because autism is such a complex condition. There are as many forms as there are people with the condition. As you mentioned, Kim Peek and myself are very, very different. So we would be on opposite ends of what is considered a spectrum condition.
Let me bring in for a moment Daniel Tammet, Dr. Geraldine Dawson. She is a professor of psychology at the University of Washington, director of the university's autism program. Dr. Dawson, welcome back.
Thank you.
Tell us what scientists might learn from Daniel Tammet when he describes his thought processes so articulately. How does that further scientific study?
Well, of course, anytime we are able to study someone who's so unusual, it also teaches us something about all of us, because we can contrast his brain with ours. And certainly the fact that he has this amazing memory calls into question what parts of the brain are handling that. Is there a special way that his brain was wired up that allows him to have these incredible memory feats? So it just gives us insight into how the brain works, and it not only sheds light on his own brain, but on ours as well.
I'd like to take a call now from Nashville, Tennessee. Catherine is on the line. Catherine, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
I was curious if Daniel in the past has ever taken paint to paper and painted these beautiful number landscapes that he describes, if he would consider doing that, or if he already has, and I'll hang up to better hear his reply.
Thank you. Good question. Daniel, have you?
I I have actually, yes. I drew the pi landscape, the first 20 digits of how I see the number pi. I painted for 60 Minutes, which was shown last month. And I've had such an amazing response to that because I have a website and people find me through the internet and they send me lots and lots of emails, which is wonderful. And I do try to respond to as many as possible. And so many people wrote and said that they loved this picture and they wanted, if they could, to get a copy of the picture.
Can you
So
tell us what it looked like?
it's very hard to put into words. It's just very complex, lots of colors, lots of green and blue colors, especially in the first 20 digits. And it's quite a lumpy number as well. It's very, very beautiful to me.
Did the scientists say what they saw or what they might have gleaned from what you drew?
I think what they found so interesting is the link between memory and making something intangible, like a sequence of numbers. For most people, that's just squiggles on a page, and how I could see them as these colors and shapes and textures. And so, there's a puzzle as to where that comes from, but also it does fit with what we already know, that if people are able to use pictures to use the more visual parts of their brain more, then it does improve memory in everyone.
I want to take a call now from Buffalo, New York. Ron is on the line. Hello, Ron.
Good morning, Gene. Hi, Gene. Mr. Tamman, it's a pleasure to be on with you. Just a quick observation and then a question for you. It really is encouraging to hear you talk. We have a son who's 2 years old. He's not yet been diagnosed or evaluated, though he will be soon. There's some suspicion that we may be looking at some form of autism or Asperger's, and it was interesting to hear you say that you played with toys in an idiosyncratic way. So does he. Particularly, he spins objects around and around and is very fascinated with that. My question for you, though, I heard you say that numbers had a way of relaxing you, and it struck me that that's much the same way, I think. I suspect that music relaxes me and other people. Do you have any thoughts on the relationship between mathematics and music that's been observed by some people?
Thank you for your question, Ron. Daniel?
I certainly love listening to music and listen to all sorts of music and listen to music every day. I don't think there's a single day when I don't listen to music at some length, and it certainly does help calm me. You're absolutely right that there is a relationship between mathematics and music, and it's been long observed. I think it goes back to the ancient Greeks as an observation. So certainly there is a relationship there, but I wouldn't be able to analyze it as such.
Is there a
But
particular kind of music?
well, certainly classical music, some classical music by Tchaikovsky or Beethoven or Mozart is very beautiful for me, but also modern music. I love the Carpenters. I love a lot of American pop music, the Carpenters, the Beach Boys, and some British music as well, like the Beatles, is very pleasurable for me.
Can you tell us what voices sound like to you?
The way that I describe very particular types of voices, loud voices in particular, I describe them as a very dark blue color. So if there is an argument, when I was a child and my parents were arguing, I would see that argument in my head as a very dark blue color, and I knew that this wasn't a good sound, and I would put my fingers in my ears and press my head against the carpet just to try and get some texture into my head and try to get the sound, the color out of my head.
Go back to your world of numbers. Daniel, I know you often speak to parents of autistic children. What do you tell them?
One of the most important things I tell them, I suppose, is to look at things as positively as possible, because very often when you have a diagnosis of autism, it can be such a shock. It can be because very often, I don't know what it's like in America so much, but in Britain, certainly, there's a very negative portrayal in the media of autism as a condition, and a very narrow view of it as well, as the most extreme forms of the condition are often the ones that the media tend to focus on. And in fact, as diagnoses have grown, I think most especially because we are now able, with the advances in technology, to and our understanding of the condition to see and understand how much more complex a condition it is than we could before. Mm. So much more mild forms, such as mine, are being diagnosed. And what that means is the condition is so complex, you shouldn't automatically assume your child is not going to be capable of a happy and productive life. Mm. I'm proof that even with epilepsy, even having come through epilepsy, even having come through all the things that I've come through in my life, that it is possible to have a happy and a successful life. Mm.
Let me turn back for a moment to Dr. Geraldine Dawson, University of Washington, director of the university's Autism Center. This week, doctor, there was news of an autism gene, in fact, two genetic links to autism. How does that news impact our understanding of and treatment for autism and Asperger syndrome, among others?
Well, I think the important point there is that we still don't know at a biological level what causes autism. I mean, it's still very much an enigma to us. And so we do know that genetic factors are involved. And by identifying a gene, then we get sort of a handle on what might be going on at a molecular or biological level. So, for example, we discovered that this gene, Neurexone 1, it seems to be involved with autism, and we know that that gene is related to the production of a specific neurotransmitter, glutamate, that is involved in learning. So that's a major insight into what might help explain why many of the children do have trouble with learning. Mm. And then, of course, the hope is that we could actually develop medications where we could alter this chemistry for children that aren't as successful as Daniel has been. Mm.
Dr. Geraldine Dawson, I appreciate your time with us today. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'd like to go back to the phones now. Deborah is calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hello, Deborah.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. What's your question?
Well, fairly recently, we've had a terrible tragedy in our town, a young man in our public high school who has Asperger syndrome. Brought a knife to school and, for reasons unknown, got into a fight with another special needs boy and stabbed him, and the young man ended up dying, which sparked a huge controversy about the use of medication in the treatment of autism. I think only 1 or 2 days later, we had a group representing the Church of Scientology picketing on our town green about the use of medication, and I think a lot of people know their stand on medication and psychology in general.
So your question is for Daniel, the treatment of autism with medication. Daniel, what do you think of that?
I certainly think that in cases where a condition is preventing a child from reaching its potential, his or her potential, is preventing that child from having as best a chance as possible of a happy and productive life, whatever that might mean, and it will mean something different in each child's case. Medication can play a role and should play a role. My brother, for example, I have a younger brother who also has Asperger syndrome, and he takes medication for depression, because depression is quite often something that coexists with an autistic spectrum disorder. So he takes medication, and the family have found that it has really helped him with his ability to cope with the world around him, because as I mentioned before, we feel so often bombarded. Our senses are so sensitive, and we can feel overwhelmed with information and colours and textures just pouring into our head. And if medication can help us to control that, then that's all the better. And the last thing I would say is I think the Church of Scientology are really stupid if they believe that medication is in all cases inappropriate. And I really would totally reject out of hand that advice, and I think people should not go to something like the Church of Scientology for advice on medication.
Let's go to Boston. Another caller, Jennifer, is on the line. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello, and hello to Daniel. I have a 10-year-old son who has been diagnosed with Asperger syndrome a couple of years ago, and one of the challenges that he faces, and I think a lot do, is more in the social landscape, in forming friendships and having a chance to, deal with other children. So I mm-hmm. wonder if you could talk a little bit about your experiences as a child in forming friendships and also into your adult life with your social life and your social circumstances? Mm.
Thank you. Good question, Jennifer. Daniel, have your social skills evolved from childhood to adulthood?
They certainly have evolved. I think that's a very important message to send to parents everywhere with autistic children, that it's a condition that does improve with age very often, that a child, as they get older, they do develop skills and do evolve as human beings, as social people. And certainly in my case, I had no awareness of other people until about the age of 8 or 9, at which point suddenly I felt this emotion which I couldn't find a word for, and which I subsequently found was what people describe as loneliness. And I so longed for a friend at that point for the first time in my life, outside of numbers, and was very difficult for a long time because I struggled to maintain eye contact. I didn't know when to laugh at a joke, how to read people's body language, didn't understand the concept of personal space. And it took me a long, long time, step by step, for me to learn each of those things very consciously. And over time, it meant that I got better and better. And as I got better and better, my confidence rose. It made it easier for me to continue on with that process. Mm. Hopefully that will be the case for your son as well.
Mm. Thank you for your call. Jamie is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. Sorry if I sound shaky. I've been crying. I have a six-year-old who is diagnosed with autism, and he seems to have a lot of the memorization ability that I hear Daniel, you know, talking about. I mean, he was counting past 100 before he was talking in sentences. And when he was 3 and a half, he sat down in front of a piano for the first time and played "Twinkle Twinkle Little Star." And I was just wondering how, you know, if there are ways I can kind of bring that out, you know, a little bit more, because he won't do these things if people ask him to. He just does it on his own and just kind of like nurtured that talent.
Good question, Jamie. Daniel, how does someone like Jamie nurture the unique abilities of her autistic son?
Well, it's a very good point that Jamie makes about not trying to ask her son to do things. As we found out earlier in this interview, when you asked me to do a sum, there is something in an autistic person's makeup. It's very hard for us to answer a sum, to answer a question, you know, a certain thing outright. Very often it has to be when we want to do something, and we can't always be in control of that. So though I'm articulate with you now, I can't really explain what goes on in my head, and it's not a switch, unfortunately, that it's possible to switch on and off. And so in the case of Jamie's son, I would urge caution, not to put too much pressure on her son, obviously, and that obviously goes for all children, but to give him as much resource as possible. I loved books. I loved reading as much as possible, because then my mind was opened up to a whole world of information and ideas. So I think it would be useful if there's a public library close by to you to go there often with your son. And it's a beautiful environment because it's quiet, it's orderly, and there are people around him, but there won't be too many people. They won't be noisy. It's a very good way of opening your child up to the outside world and also to the world of ideas and information.
I remember in your book you talk about when you met Kim Peek, the real-life character who inspired the movie Rain Man, the story of the autistic savant. You met him in a public library.
And, that's right.
And you two were reading books together, delving into them books at a time.
That's right. And swapping facts and figures in the way that people swap gossip with each other.
Will you tell the fun story that you tell in your book about your trip to Las Vegas with Kim Peek?
Well, I went to Las Vegas. That was actually not with Kim Peek. That was before I went to Salt Lake City. And it was to give a fun angle, I suppose, for people watching the documentary that was being made about me. Because a lot of people, they remember this sequence from the movie Rain Man. And so they wanted to put my abilities to the test in this way. So the documentary crew took me to Las Vegas, took me to a casino. The first time I'd been to a casino in my life, I didn't know the rules of blackjack. I had to learn them before I went into the casino. And it was taped. So there were people, it was being filmed. There were people who could see this and were curious and crowding around me, watching me as I played. At one point in the game, the dealer had a 10, which is a very good card, of course, and I was given 2 sevens, which is a very poor hand, and I asked to split this hand, which is a very unusual way of playing. It's not recommended play in most cases. And I was given a third card, which was also a seven. And I asked if I could split this card. And the people behind me were tutting. They're obviously much more experienced blackjack players, and thought, I must be crazy, because this is a very, very unusual way of playing blackjack. And what subsequently happened is she dealt the cards out on each seven. And the first one total 21, the second one total 21, and the third one total 21. So I beat the house.
Made a clean sweep.
Absolutely.
You know, earlier you talked about every number has a shape and a color and a texture for you. Every number up to 10,000, is that
right?
That's
right, that's right. And words as well. So your name, Jane, it's a very... I was thinking to myself, it's a beautiful name because it's a yellow color, and I love the color yellow.
Thank you. They are living, breathing things for you, numbers, and I wanted you to describe some of them for us, would you?
Sure.
The number, say, eight.
The number eight is round, and it's like lots of dots flying around in circles, intermingling with one another. A very busy number.
What about five?
Five is loud, like thunder, and shiny and bright. Very, very friendly number as well, I should say.
What about zero?
Zero, I don't really have much of a relationship with, like the number six as well, for some reason. Zero is very small, it's very cold, and the number six is the only number other than zero that I picture smaller than zero. Six is the smallest number for me. I don't know why, but when I was a child and I didn't understand what sadness was, I would use the number six to help me to understand it, because six is so cold and dark and hollow. I would imagine myself inside the number six, and it would make me feel something like the emotion of sadness.
333.
333 is a round number. It's a green number. It's also a very bright number. It's, I would say, chubby as well.
Jeff is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Jeff, hello.
Hello, Jane. Daniel, thank you for taking my call. Sure. I've got a two-part question, and I'll take my answer off the air. You've made many references to color and textures associated with numbers. Is that a solid that everybody within the Savant community sees, let's say, number four as being soft and green, or is that unique to your romance with numbers? And then secondly, when you did the pie marathon, although that's an infinite number, was there some sorrow or sadness when you left that dance with those numbers and chose to stop?
Good questions, Jeff. Thank you. Daniel?
The difficulty that we have with other savants is that some of them, not all of them, but some of them are non-communicative because of the nature of their disability. And so it's very difficult for researchers to understand exactly what they are doing in their minds and what makes my case so useful for researchers. Why I feel it is important for me to keep working with researchers is because I am able to give them that window. I can't say that my experience is typical. I don't know how other savants experience the world and whether there are similarities or not. I know that some people who aren't necessarily savants have written to me since reading my book and said, yes, I see numbers in colours and sometimes in shapes as well. So there are similarities with people who are autistic and some people who aren't autistic. As for Pi, yes, I felt sadness to leave it behind me after I finished, but the thing that I found most interesting after finishing was I talked with people, because it was a public event, there were members of the public there watching me doing the recitation, and they told me afterwards, some people told me afterwards, that they could see people crying as I was reciting a number, and they asked them afterwards, why are you crying? And they said, it's a very spiritual experience, the feeling of it, that I was reciting something almost like scripture, and that I was unearthing something, a number that is so close to us. Every circle that we can imagine uses this number pi, but it's such a huge number that we never hear more than a few places of it. And here I was unearthing into the public gaze thousands of digits that will never be heard, were never heard before, and will probably not be heard again.
Let me ask you about the title of your book in our final moments here, Daniel, Born on a Blue Day. To most people, to say born on a blue day, that would mean it was a sad day when you were born. Is that what you meant?
No, it wasn't. What I meant was I was born on a Wednesday, and Wednesdays are blue. Every day of the week, like numbers and words, have their own colours. I mentioned before that you were born on a Tuesday, and a Tuesday is an orange colour. So you would be born on an orange day. I don't know if I have a favourite day of the week. As with numbers, it's like a mother trying to choose her favourite child. I don't know if I should. But each one is beautiful and each one is special to me.
Do you ever tire, Daniel, of people that respond with such awe at your extraordinary abilities?
I don't mind, because what I found in all of this experience is that what was before a barrier for me, the children certainly in the playground would have considered me a freak. And so my abilities actually alienated other people from me. But now it's different. What was a barrier is now a bridge. People are interested in me. They come towards me. That's a wonderful thing. Mm.
Daniel Tammet, an autistic savant with extraordinary abilities. His new memoir is called Born on a Blue Day. Daniel Tammet, it's been a real pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.